This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, March 9, 2006. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, President Bush signs the Patriot Act into law. We'll hear the latest from Washington. Environmentalists, doctors, scientists, and farm workers testify against the EPA's proposed rule changes for particulate matter. And the debate is growing for creating a witness protection program in India. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Dubai Ports World, the United Arab Emirates port management company, announced today that it will transfer the operation duties of a number of U.S. ports to an American company. This comes one day after the House of Representatives overwhelmingly approved legislation that would kill the deal to allow Dubai Ports World to administer U.S. port terminals. In Nigeria, hundreds of ExxonMobil workers were released this morning after being held overnight in a company export terminal by angry youths seeking compensation for a major oil spill. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
Several hundred youths took over ExxonMobil's export terminal at Ibeno in the Niger Delta just before close of work yesterday. The protesters prevented both foreign and local workers from leaving the premises, forcing them to spend the night in their offices. The youths want compensation for an oil spill from ExxonMobil's operations. The spill, which occurred in 1998, affected Nigeria's entire 850-kilometer-long coastline. The oil spill affected millions of people who depend on fishing for their source of livelihood. 3 years ago, a Nigerian court ordered ExxonMobil to pay $10 million as compensation to three communities affected by the spill. The company then appealed the court judgment, saying that the spill caused no adverse effects on the people or the environment. The protesters withdrew this morning after ExxonMobil agreed to hold talks on financial compensation for the disaster. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
A strike by some 4,000 contract workers at Ecuador's state-owned oil company continues in three Amazon provinces, despite a state of emergency declared by the president on Tuesday. Petroecuador has regained control of a number of facilities in the region after military forces dislodged striking workers from occupied installations yesterday. Production is slowly recovering as constitutional rights remain suspended in the three oil-rich provinces. In Florida, the supervisor of elections in Leon County, who recently exposed security flaws in Diebold voting machines, is now planning legal action against the company. From WMNF in Tampa, Andrew Stelzer has the story.
In December, Leon County Election Supervisor Ian Sancho enlisted a Finnish computer expert to try and hack the county's Diebold machines. After the hacker was successful in showing how someone inside the supervisor's office could alter election results without a trace, Sancho vowed not to use Diebold machines in another election. Since then, however, the other two companies which are approved to supply voting machines in Florida, ES&S and Sequoia, have refused to sell machines to Leon County, which left Sancho with no choice but to go with Diebold. But Diebold, despite its contract to deliver machines, is also refusing to sell them to Leon County. Now Sancho has filed notice of legal proceedings alleging the company is in breach of that contract. Because they couldn't get any new machines by a federal January 1st deadline, Leon County has already lost $500,000 in federal grants. While California's Voting Systems Assessment Board has praised Sancho's security tests, Florida's Secretary of State, appointed by Governor Jeb Bush, has threatened legal action against him. For FSRN, reporting from Tampa, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
France's Interior Minister, Nicolas Sarkozy, started a visit to the French West Indies today. It's a trip he had to postpone in December because of threats of demonstrations against him. Tony Cross reports from Paris.
Sarkozy today touches down on the island of Guadeloupe and will go on to Martinique, but he's had to wait 3 months to make his Caribbean trip. He had to cancel in December because huge protests were threatened. French West Indians, most of whom are descendants of slaves, were furious over a law passed last year which told teachers to explain the positive role of French colonialism. And, after last year's riots, they objected to Sarkozy's statements that low-income housing projects should be vacuum-cleaned of scum and gangsters. That led poet and veteran black consciousness campaigner Aimé Césaire to refuse to meet him. The controversial law has now been amended, and Sarkozy hopes that he's mended fences by writing an open letter explaining that he's gone through a process of personal development on the sensitive issue. He says he now has a better understanding of the depth of the wound and the link that could be made between colonialism and slavery. And he hopes to meet Césaire, although last Sunday the 92-year-old facetiously asked a radio interviewer, "Who is this young man and why does he want to meet me?" For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
A U.S. military spokesman announced a decision today to close the notorious Abu Ghraib prison. The facility will likely shut down within 3 months and involve the transfer of over 4,000 prisoners. A new detention facility, known as Camp Crooper, is currently under construction near the Baghdad airport. Meanwhile, the violence continues in Iraq. A car bombing in Baghdad today took the lives of at least 9 civilians, authorities said. That was just one of the attacks that claimed Iraqi and U.S. lives during the past 2 days, as sectarian violence, anti-occupation attacks, and simple lawlessness continue in the country. Against the backdrop of political meetings that threaten to open even greater divisions, others continue to call for unity. In this report, narrated and produced by David Enders, Salam Talib spoke with people in Baghdad about the ongoing violence.
Fadl al-Shara is the Baghdad representative of cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, whose militia is blamed for much of the violence. Al-Shara has spent much of the last 2 weeks attempting to deflect such accusations and to appeal to Sunni leaders for unity across the sects. Shara said the destruction and the sectarian killings that took place following the attack on the Asghariya shrine in Samarra 2 weeks ago were a reaction to the forced removal of Shiites, especially in rural areas outside Baghdad, during the last 2 years. Many of those displaced settled in already overcrowded Sadr City, home to at least 2 million poor Shiites on the edge of the capital before the migration.
There are many families that have been removed from their homes and are now in Shula, Sadr City, Babylon, Karbala. They've been kicked out of cities like Fallujah, Dora, Nahrawan, because they are the minorities in those cities. Some other families left their homes after they received threats, or family members had already been injured. Still others left because they were afraid.
Al-Shara said that fighters loyal to Sadr have remained at Sunni mosques in order to protect them, and that the real threat to Iraqi unity was the occupation. The Sadrists rely heavily on the past history of British colonialists and Ottoman domination in what is now present-day Iraq. Both groups often conspired to keep local leaders feuding rather than united.
The hands of the occupation are trying to build differences between people, and this is normal. Every occupied force for any country will try to divide and roll. We saw it in Palestine and Lebanon, but I think it will be different in Iraq, because Iraqi society is not built on just religion, but it is built on tribal connections too. And you can see that there are many tribes that are half Sunni and half Shia. They have lots of marriages between the families, and they are not going to kill their relatives.
Muhammad al-Azawi is a Sunni living in Baghdad. Though intersect marriages, once somewhat common, have almost disappeared since the invasion, he also expressed hope. Many Sunnis see Sadr as the country's last best hope to avoid a full-scale sectarian conflict. Many Iraqis have asserted during the last 3 years that the only way to keep the country from breaking apart is to have it ruled by a strongman.
You cannot say it is the civil war in Iraq, especially after Muqtada al-Sadr went to Abu Hanifa, the Sunni shrine in Baghdad, and prayed along with the Sunni imam. The next day, I saw in many places banners calling Sunni and Shia to come together to start rebuilding the Sunni mosques that have been bombed. Many people volunteered.
Also on Thursday, the Iraqi government met for the first time since January's elections to discuss the reappointment of Ibrahim al-Jafari to the post of prime minister. Jafari, who has been submitted by the parliament's majority Shiite bloc for the post of prime minister, is not supported by Kurdish leaders, pointing to another fault line in the country, the Kurdish north in the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. Jalal Talabani, the head of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, favors Adil Abdulmehdi, another conservative Shiite but a member of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Skiri favors autonomy for the country's southern provinces, similar to what the Kurds are pushing for in the north. Jafari's nomination was pushed through by followers of Sadr, who has demanded that Kirkuk remain part of Iraq. Many Shiites in Kirkuk are followers of Sadr. I'm David Enders with Salam Talib for FSRN.
Both houses of Congress are poised to approve a $90 billion supplemental. $20 billion would go to Hurricane Katrina relief efforts, and $70 billion would continue to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld asked the Senate today to quickly pass the measure, and although a House committee passed the measure last night, the proceeding was disrupted by anti-war activists.
Stop funding the torture of people! Stop funding extraordinary resistance! Stop it! Stop it!
This war is
stop
illegal!
Stop funding the war! Stop funding the war! The blood is on your hands! The blood is on your hands! How many more?
You know this war is wrong! It is wrong! You have got to stop
how many more Iraqi Americans must die?
Members of Voices for Creative Nonviolence are in the middle of a 34-day fast outside the Capitol in opposition to the war. Congress could pass the $90 billion supplemental as early as next week. In other news on Capitol Hill, President Bush has signed the USA Patriot Act into law. The law makes 14 of the 16 provisions from the original Patriot Act permanent and is being hailed by supporters as necessary to provide the government the tools with which to apprehend terrorists. Meanwhile, opponents to the Patriot Act are working to make right where they say the Patriot Act goes wrong. Leanne Caldwell reports.
And now it's my honor to sign the USA Patriot Improvement and Reauthorization Act of 2005.
And with the president's signature from the East Room in the White House, the Patriot Act is renewed.
It'll improve our nation's security while we safeguard the civil liberties of our people.
But that law, labeled as anti-terrorism legislation, does not protect civil liberties. Rather, it infringes upon them, according to its critics. Lisa Graves is senior counsel for legislative strategy at the American Civil Liberties Union.
The most significant flaw in the Patriot Act, among many flaws, is the fact that it allows the federal government to obtain literally any tangible thing about a person, medical records, financial records, tax records, library records, book records, what have you, without establishing that those records are about a suspected terrorist or an American suspected of conspiring with such a terrorist.
Although most lawmakers voted in support of the Patriot Act, some believe it has flaws.
Felt that it went too far, especially with an administration that doesn't care to follow the law.
Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont is one of 12 senators supporting legislation that would restore some civil protections the Patriot Act removes. Four of those senators are Republican. The legislation was introduced this week by Judiciary Committee Chair Arlen Specter, who was also standing right next to the president at the signing ceremony. The bill would narrow the criteria that would allow authorities to search someone's personal records. A connection would have to be shown relating a person to a suspected terrorist before their personal records can be obtained. It would also provide judicial review of certain provisions, and it would sunset the National Security Letter provision after 4 years for it to be reviewed. The Washington Post reports that 30,000 National Security Letters are sent out each year, warning people they are being watched because of suspected ties to terrorism. Senator John Kerry supports the legislation.
I want to guarantee that the things I didn't like with respect to privacy or other things, where there are still things I think we could do better. And I want to do better.
Do you think that it wasn't important enough to oppose it the
not
first time?
Not against the balance. We got a lot of things fixed. We made a lot of progress. And we fixed some of the things that were of great concern to me before. But when you balance it against the larger security needs, I believed it was important to get it done with the notion that we are going to fight to fix it. And I think, that's the sensible way to come at it.
Leaders of the Senate Judiciary Committee will try and pass this legislation and push it onto the Senate floor for a vote. The Republican-led House of Representatives is unlikely to take up this bill. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Senate Intelligence Committee voted this week to block an investigation into the National Security Agency's warrantless domestic spying program, but the American Civil Liberties Union, along with the Center for Constitutional Rights and an Islamic charity in Oregon, refused to back down on the issue. As FSRN's Julie Sabatier reports from Portland, Oregon, all three organizations have all filed lawsuits challenging the legality of domestic surveillance.
Federal lawsuits filed last month by the ACLU in Detroit and the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York accused President Bush of overstepping his powers by ordering the surveillance of American citizens. A suit filed last week in Oregon also requests that the surveillance program be shut down immediately. This suit has one thing the others don't have: physical evidence.
I joke with my friends that it might be an old sock, it could be a document, it could be anything you want to guess that it might be, but there is what I would call evidence under seal with the court's office.
That's Tom Nelson, lead prosecutor in the case filed by Al Haramain, an Islamic charity with a branch in Ashland, Oregon. Nelson is not at liberty to comment on the nature of the evidence, but the civil suit alleges that communications between the organization's leaders and two attorneys, both U.S. citizens, were monitored. The Oregon branch of Al Haramain was effectively shut down 2 years ago when the government labeled it a global terrorist organization. Al Haramain was involved in outreach to Muslims in Chechnya at the time. The U.S. government became suspicious of the funds moving through the Oregon branch to the main headquarters in Saudi Arabia and froze Al Haramain's assets. Again, Tom Nelson.
The designation ultimately does have very bad effects both upon the charity, which was designated, is essentially out of business, even though it's still a living corporation. Its assets will be sold, I think, in April of this year and by the United States government. And we'll see what happens to the proceeds. It also has very severe impacts upon those individuals who are designated as terrorists.
Department of Justice spokesperson Brian Rorchesi, who declined to be interviewed on the air, said in a prepared statement that the department believes the terrorist surveillance program has always been conducted in accordance with the law and provides a critical tool in the war on terror. In addition to the lawsuit filed in Portland last week, Nelson has filed a Freedom of Information request regarding the wiretapping of conversations between himself and his clients, which he believes may have been unauthorized. For FSRN, I'm Julie Sabatier in Portland, Oregon.
India's Supreme Court punishment of a Gujarat riot witness for perjury has opened a debate about tightening laws to protect witnesses. Witnesses changing their statements is nothing new in the Indian judiciary, but the participation of states and influential rich individuals pressuring witnesses is drawing sharp criticism. As FSRN's Benu Alex reports, there is growing debate for a witness protection program.
It all started with Zahira Sheikh, who changed her testimony four times during the Best Bakery trial. In one instance, she said she had been threatened by local politicians. The Supreme Court ordered a retrial outside Gujarat, saying a free and fair trial was not possible in the state. 14 of her family members were burnt alive in the 2002 Hindu-Muslim violence in the western Indian province of Gujarat. Last month, 9 men were convicted for this, and yesterday, Zahira was sentenced to a year in prison for perjury. According to a report released last year by the Indian central government, the Gujarat riots claimed the lives of 254 Hindus and 790 Muslims. An estimated 223 others remained missing. It is considered one of the worst waves of violence in recent history. 4 years later, the cases are dragging in the Indian courts, with witnesses frequently changing testimonies, and the pro-Hindu BJP government in Gujarat allegedly weakening the prosecution. The case against Zahira was filed by human rights activist Tista Setalwad, whose support initially gave Zahira the courage to stand against the accused before she changed again.
When you see the way mass crimes happen, you look at the state of Gujarat today, where even now witnesses are being intimidated by accused, supported by MLAs and members of the state. I repeat that Zahira Sheikh is a pawn in a much bigger game.
Now that Sheikh is sentenced, Taster is targeting the politicians who allegedly bribed her. Otherwise, she says there could be many more Zahiras. The judgment, according to judicial activists, sets a precedent that could radically change the way criminal proceedings are administered in India. The country is plagued by witnesses who change their testimonies either for financial gain or after being threatened by people seeking to protect the accused. The verdict against Sheikh has come at a time when a widespread debate is on for greater witness protection laws. Last month, a judge acquitted two men charged for killing of a model 7 years ago while she was standing bar in New Delhi. Though hundreds witnessed the shooting and even testified in court, they later recounted and destroyed the prosecution's case. Young parliamentarians like Sachin Pilot are of the opinion that the courts will have to play a more proactive role to arrive at the truth.
There is a strong sentiment, I think it is across the country, that what is apparently obvious should not be missed by the courts. There is no dearth of laws in this country, but still we find people get away with certain things. So I think that's why there has been a huge undercurrent in the society, and a perception has taken ground that something needs to be done. And I think subsequently many steps have been taken to rectify what people thought was a mistake.
But in a country where these mistakes of acquittals have become a common phenomenon and where witnesses are either threatened or at times even killed or forced to change testimonies, human rights activists argue protection is necessary to restore a sense of human dignity which stands shattered in a situation like Gujarat violence. From Ahmedabad, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Mauritania's new ruler, Colonel Eli Old Mohamed Val, was in Senegal for 2 days this week, where some Mauritanian refugees have lived in exile for the past 17 years. For years, the Mauritanian government denied there were Mauritanian refugees in the Senegal River Valley and instead considered them Senegalese nationals. From Senegal, Njaga Sek reports.
Last August, the Military Council for Justice and Democracy, led by Colonel Eli Old Mohamed Val, came to power in Mauritania after a bloodless coup. At that point, some hoped the military junta would settle the plight of thousands of Mauritanians who found refuge in Senegal. An estimated 65,000 black Mauritanians fled into northern Senegal and Mali between 1989 and 1991 to escape ethnic violence that killed hundreds. Although many later returned, they often found it difficult to regain civil rights, employment, and property. Defending the rights of some 25,000 refugees, the African Liberation Forces of Mauritania, FLAM, called upon Colonel Val to end 17 years of exile. Mohamed Ali is a member of FLAM.
As the Mauritanian president is on an official visit in Senegal, we wanted to show him that we are Mauritanian refugees. Because the main problem is the president doesn't accept there are Mauritanian refugees in Senegal. So we had placards that read, "Without the return of Mauritanian refugees, there won't be peace in the sub-region. We want to go back home. We've been here for 17 years now. We have no papers, and we can't do anything. We want to go back home and participate in the political transition."
With the help of the UN High Commission for Refugees, UNHCR, and the Senegalese government, Mauritanian refugees settled on the Senegal River Valley in refugee camps like Dodel, Bakel, Njum, or Dagana. Doudouba is from Kaedi in the south of Mauritania. He was manager of a Mauritanian hospital until 1989. Now, he runs a little medical center in Dagana refugee camp and says he constantly looks forward to going back home.
I want to go back home because I know no place other than Mauritania. I grew up there, did my studies there, and worked there for 30 years as a civil servant. All conditions must be gathered for us to go back. Even if the government doesn't pay us, they should give us compensation and the most fundamental rights as Mauritanians, but not only allow us to go back just like that, If it's up to us to find papers and find jobs, it won't be easy.
Black Mauritanians found refuge in Senegal as they share the same ethnic groups as Senegalese on the Senegal River Valley. Former Mauritanian governments never agreed that refugees were Mauritanian citizens, considering them Senegalese instead. Baba Tanja, a Senegalese journalist and independent observer who often reported on the refugees' conditions, said Colonel Val agrees there are Mauritanian refugees in Senegal.
The president understands it. When we first met for an interview, he said the situation for refugees is very difficult, so when they go home, they must do it at a minimum with dignity. And the government that will come after the transition should take care of the problem. We, the Senegalese observers, won't agree that refugees go home individually.
Colonel Eli Ould Mohamed Val's transition will last another 12 months. He said time was too short for him to solve the refugees' plight, but vowed that the next government would work to restore refugees their rights. In Senegal for FSIN, I'm Jaga Sek.
The Environmental Protection Agency held its only public hearings yesterday on proposed changes to standards for the suspended dust and soot that regulators call particulate matter. According to public health advocates, the proposed new rules amount to a rollback in nearly every area and could cause tens of thousands of premature deaths per year. Brian Edwards-Tiekert reports from San Francisco, where environmentalists, doctors, scientists, and farm workers gave 12 hours of testimony during yesterday's hearing.
Far and away the most controversial part of the EPA's proposed particulate rules are exemptions covering rural areas. EPA has proposed, for instance, that agriculture and mining should not be regulated. It says there's no evidence that their dust is as harmful as that for more urban industries. That decision was roundly criticized by scientists and doctors like Michael Lipset, who say there's basically no evidence to support it.
If the EPA actually believed that its mission were to protect public health, the appropriate course of action would be to treat these categories of particles the same unless and until there are data to support making a principled distinction between them.
The proposed rules would also cease monitoring for particulate pollution in towns with less than 100,000 residents. Public health advocates from California's San Joaquin Valley, which arguably has the worst particulate pollution in the nation, say that discriminates against people living in rural areas. Carolina Simunovic works with Fresno Metro Ministries.
I think the EPA proposals are irresponsible and unethical, almost designed to harm the people that you need to protect the most. People living in poor communities, rural communities, that are exposed to pollutants, exposed to coarse particulate matter, fine particulate matter on a daily basis and need this protection.
EPA held three public hearings on the new rules, one in Philadelphia, one in Chicago, and one in San Francisco. The two areas most heavily impacted by particulate pollution, however, are the Los Angeles region and California's San Joaquin Valley. But despite the distance, some farm workers did make the six-hour drive from Tulare County to give comment. Sandy Garcia has been a farm worker for 30 years. She currently lives in Poplar.
En un lado de mi pueblo está una lechería.
She says her town is bordered by mega dairies on both sides, and her neighbors suffer from breathing dirt, cow feces, and pesticide-laced dust. She says without an air monitor in her area, there will be no one to listen to her concerns. Unfortunately, the hearing's organizers had not arranged for translation services, so most of the people in the room didn't hear her concerns yesterday either. EPA staff will review public comment from yesterday's hearings before finalizing the rule sometime this spring. They'll accept written comment until April 17th. In San Francisco, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.